I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, the weekly podcast illuminating issues in agriculture and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are answered using a science-based approach with the goal of driving innovation to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Paul Vincelli.
Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast, the weekly podcast where we discuss contemporary issues in science and technology with a focus on biotechnology and new innovations that can help people and the planet. I'm Paul Vincelli, sitting in for Dr. Kevin Falta, and today we'll be talking about de novo domestication of wild species. And if you don't know what that means, I didn't know what it meant the first time I heard it, but hang with us. You're going to find out. So our guest today is Dr. Lázaro Pérez. He is a plant physiologist from the University of São Paulo in Brazil. And Lázaro, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Paul. It's my pleasure to make this interview. Well, de novo domestication, as you said, it's a quite new term that we coined it. It's about related to domestication that is a topic of a broad interest. So it's related to the plants and the animals that we use to see and to interact every day. So when we see these animals and plants, we should have in mind that they were domesticated 100 or even 1,000 years ago. And people don't use to try to domesticate them again. That's why this topic is quite funny, because it's what we are meaning is that we want to try to do this again, but we are not having in mind that we will take a long time again.
So the idea here is to actually to domesticate species that we don't already consume. Is that a good way to describe it?
Yes. I should say first that we already are using many wild species, but what we used to do is to try to find the genes behind the traits of interest in these wild species and try to put them into a cultivate plant. Let's say if we have in mind plant that is my subject area. And this is a very good approach. We have breeders are using this for a long time. And although we are not aware about the plants that we eat in this day, many of them have traits that came from wild species. And but one problem behind this approach is that in some case, especially when we are talking about stress resistant, the traits that we find in the wild species, they are not monogenic. That means we can't manipulate this trait as a single genes that we can transfer by crosses to a related cultivated plant, or even to transfer to an unrelated plant by genetic transformation, because the trait is controlled by many genes, so you can't manipulate many genes at the time.
So, and that's true for conventional breeding as well as genetic engineering, is what you're saying.
In both cases, this will be very difficult. And one interesting thing is that
And so let me just make sure to repeat and make sure we're our audience is understanding. So let's take the case. I think you've used the case of salt tolerance, for example. The genes for salt tolerance in a wild species are rather complex, and so transferring that into cultivated tomato is quite difficult. And it, is that a fair summary?
Yeah, this is a very good example. There are salt resistant in the other kind of species, but this trait is very important in tomato. One thing that makes this so interesting is that when you think about tomato, that is a species from the genus Solanus, it has different wild species that are related to tomato. One of them is Solanus galapagensis, that is endemic to the Galapagos Island. It was collected for the first time by Charles Darwin. One thing that is behind this species is that it evolves in the seashore of some island of Galapagos. So this species has a lot of salt resistant, but we know now that this kind of resistance may be polygenic, because we have tried to transfer this to cultivate tomato, and you can't get Mendelian segregation for the trait. This is typical for something that is polygenic.
Okay, so polygenic for our listeners is many genes, and which makes it complex to transfer or next to impossible. And when you refer to Mendelian segregation, you're basically, Lassiter is referring to the relative ease of moving a genetic trait, because it moves as a single gene in a predictable fashion.
Perfect, yes. And talk about Mendelian genes. It's in the other hand is quite interesting that now we know that many genes that were selected during domestication behave as monogenic genes. That means that they are controlled by genes of major effect. A good example using tomato, that is the species that we use as a model, is fruit size. So in the case of fruit size, although you can link many lossy, that is lossy, a different region of the genome that are related to a trait, but in the case of tomato, we know that it takes three or two genes to improve the size of a fruit. Or to double the size of the fruit, or to improve it 100%.
So two or three genes.
Two or three genes. So this is okay. Quite exciting, because we can put this two traits in a comparison. So you want the stress resistant that is polygenic. And in the other side, you have the domesticated genes that are monogenic. So this gave us the idea that we can do the reverse. I'll say this again. Taking into account the genes that are behind the domesticated trait as monogenic, the idea of the de novo domestication is to try to reproduce the same genes and the same mutations in the wild species. So in the case of the fruit size, for example, that species, the Solanus galapagensis, that is salt resistant, it has a fruit that is already edible, but it's a very small fruit. So even if you have in mind a cherry or a grape size fruit that now is very common in tomato, especially in the gourmet tomato, the size of the fruit of Solanus galapagensis it's a pea size fruit. So it's not of a commercial value. So it's manipulating this two or three genes in the genome of Solanus galapagensis. You can improve the size of the fruit that is already edible. So So it's a very good approach, and it's also important because using this, you can maintain the polygenic genes that in the genome of Solano galapagensis.
Yeah. So I found this concept actually really interesting, and that's why I'm so glad that you've been patient with me in the difficulties we've had in getting a good quality audio. But for the listeners, what Lacerdo is doing is turning breeding in a way sort of on its head. Instead of moving the complex genetics of salt tolerance into cultivated tomato, you're attempting the reverse, which is to move or edit certain domestication genes that occur in the domesticated tomato, editing the genes in the wild species for fruit size, which is simpler to do than to move the genetics of salt tolerance.
That's correct. Yes.
That is just really astounding. So how does, it seems like a great idea, you know, to try doing this, and seems to make sense. How does the Solanum galapagensis taste? It's got a very small fruit, size of a pea, but how does it taste?
Yeah, this is a very good question, because there are people that has the concern that the fruit is a little bit bitter. And also it's not a red fruit that people that used to eat tomato is very bound to the red fruit of tomatoes. It's symbolic that you have a red fruit, and the fruit of Solano galapagensis, it's actually the color of the fruit is orange. But this is quite interesting. It's quite easy to manipulate, because in both cases, what we have, it's a loss of function mutation. In the case of tomato, as many people already know, the red color of tomato is related to lycopene, that is a red carotenoid, and the and the orange color of the fruit of Solano galapagensis is related to beta carotene, that is also good for your health, but
and which is in carrot, the orange color of carrot.
Yeah. This is the same same carotenoid that we have in carrot. And what caused this is that it's just because the enzyme it's also monogenic. It's a single gene that codes for an enzyme that transforms lycopene into beta carotene. So a way to make a Solano galapagensis a red fruit in Solano galapagensis is just to create a mutation in the gene that convert the lycopene into beta carotene, so you have the same color of conventional tomato. This is a very good example. Although for some people to have orange fruit with beta carotene will be also good for your health. And this is also related to gourmet tomato. They like to sell them in different colors, so this may be good. We can create different lines, red and orange one. But the most important modification is in the genes that cause the enlargement of the fruit. And in this case, it's very important to say that the major genes that were domesticated or were selected during tomato domestication are also related to loss of function. This is a kind of modification that is easier to reproduce in a wild species. And I must say too that now we have more technologies to do this, that is genome editing. And for example, using CRISPR-Cas technology, we can make initially transgenic plants using guide RNA to target the genes that we want to knock out to improve the size of the fruit into Solano galapagensis.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, so there are a couple points I want to follow up on with you, and really, really well described in the review paper that you've published. One before the break, I want to just revisit just to make sure our listeners understand, because I think sometimes trying to picture things without images and graphics and all that is, you know, it's challenging for me, but the orange color in, and so this is a really good example. The orange color in Solanum galapagensi is due to the transformation of lycopene into beta carotene. And so what, and this is just what you said, but I'm just repeating. So what has happened in nature with a cultivated tomato is that a mutation occurred so that the lycopene accumulates and beta carotene is not formed. And your concept here domesticating Solanum galapagensi is to create a mutation that accomplishes the same thing, but to do it in Solanum galapagensi, modeled after what you found in the cultivated tomato. Have I described it properly?
Yeah, it's quite correct. Technically, what occurs in tomato is not really a mutation. It's a far more complex. The enzyme, the name of the enzyme is lycopene beta cyclase of tomato. It has some activity, but it has a control during fruit ripening that put the expression down, and that's why it's not accumulating beta carotene. But although we are not doing the same kind of complex modification for example, in the promoter region of the gene of Solanum galapagensis, we can do this easily, just creating a simple mutation that is a knockout. That means we will destroy the whole expression of the gene, and this is
gotcha.
Is something that is. It's not a problem for tomato, because this gene in special is designed to express only in the fruit, so it's okay for the plant.
Yeah. Okay. So what nature has taught you through the domestication process is that there's this particular enzyme that we can that is downregulated.
Yeah.
That results in the lycopene accumulation, and so you don't have to edit Solanum galapagensi with the same editing as what you say, with the same change, just some change in some way that causes a loss of function in that enzyme, and you end up accumulating lycopene.
I think that's correct. Yes.
Good. And good.
In the case of the genes that enlarge the size of the fruit, it's quite the same, because in the case of one of the major genes, that is fruit weight 22, that was cloned by Steve Tansky many years ago, it's a complex mutation that occurs during tomato domestication. But we can create the same phenotype just doing a kind of a knockout mutation in Solanum galapagensis.
Beautiful. Yeah, well explained. Well, I'm understanding it better and better every time I talk to you, so thanks for that. And so with that, we'll take a short break. We're talking to Dr. Lázaro Pérez, a plant physiologist from the University of São Paulo in Brazil. And when we come back, we're going to continue to talk about de novo domestication of wild species. And we really appreciate you, listeners, and thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast.
Hi, everybody. This is Kevin Folta.
And this is Paul Vincelli.
And we're here talking about the next generation of potential opportunities with the Talking Biotech podcast.
And we have a very special invitation for you.
Okay, so here's the deal. What we're looking for is to expand the opportunities of using this vehicle to expose more people to the opportunities within science communication. How do you build your brand by potentially hosting a Talking Biotech episode?
Hosting a Talking Biotech episode accomplishes many things for me. One is I learn more about a topic that I'm interested in. And two is I develop some skills on science communication and do it in a way that's really quite friendly and interactive.
So how you do it is really simple. All you need to do is identify someone you would like to talk to, learn something about what they do, make the interview time to talk to them and have the conversation. It's really simple. You do that, send us the audio files, and I'll take care of the rest.
And I'll offer myself to mentor somebody who wants to, stick their toe in the water and try it out.
Yeah. And in the days of standing up for science, there's no better way for you to stand up for the science you enjoy and that you would like to communicate to others than to share those important stories. And use this platform to talk about what you're interested in.
So think about it. It's a wonderful opportunity, and we're excited to extend it to you.
And now back to the Talking Biotech Podcast.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech Podcast with Dr. Lázaro Pérez, a Brazilian plant physiologist who works at the University of Sao Paulo. And, I didn't say in the beginning, Lázaro, we had a couple meals together in Montevideo, Uruguay, while we were both down there, and had some wonderful food and some wonderful conversations. It was a real pleasure to get to know you, and I'm thrilled that you could join us.
It's my pleasure, Paul.
Let me come back here and just hit on a couple points that I gathered from your paper, and I want to make sure our listeners understand. One thing is with this concept of de novo domestication, you're actually not transferring genes from tomato, cultivated tomato, into Solanum galbagense. You are simply using what you learn from cultivated tomato to make genome edits to Solanum galbagense. So you're not really adding any genetics at all. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, this is a very, very important point, because we are not actually, as you said, transfer genes from cultivated tomato into Solanum galbagense, but since Solanum galbagense is a species very related to tomato, what we have is in Solanum galbagense genome, we have actually the same genes that tomato has. But the difference is what we call allelic difference. So in the case of the, taking into account that example of the enzyme of lycopene beta cyclase, they both have the genes that code for the enzyme, but they have different alleles. So we will use the knowledge to manipulate the allele in Solanum galbagense to make it more similar to the allele that we have in tomato. And the way to do this, it involves to make a transgenic Solanum galbagense, and this is interesting because we have the technology to do genetic transformation of this species and many other species. This is in the case of plant, the technology for genetic transformation is mandatory for genome editing. And this is the kind of manipulation that we are doing. So we need to transform Solanum galbagense with a tDNA delivered from Agrobacterium, and in this tDNA we will put the enzyme that do the genome editing, that is the Cas9, and we put together with this the gene for this enzyme some information, a kind of information that we call guide RNA, that will target the genes that we want to manipulate it. So we will put the guide RNA for the genes that improve the size of the fruit, and also the genes that that change the color. And it's also important to say that Solanum galbagense, as many other species, is not only related to salt resistant, but since they evolve in different environment, there are many other very interesting traits that we don't have in cultivated tomato that we can get from this species, and most of them are also polygenic.
So yeah, and let's put those aside for just a minute, because I know there's some traits that that are important and polygenic, as you say. But I wanted to once again affirm that you're not really adding genetics to the tomato, to the wild species of tomato, but you're simply editing the genome Yeah, so that's really important. And the other thing that I wanted to highlight when I read the paper, I tweeted this actually because I thought it was so important. Your paper describes how many genes for domestication in various crops, not just tomato, are major genes, which means their inheritance is simple, and that they're loss of function genes. And if it's a loss of function gene, as you clearly point out in the paper, one can disrupt the function of that gene, and take steps towards de novo domestication with by focusing on numerous genes, because it's simply a matter of creating a loss of function, which could be you're not adding new genetics, you're not adding a new feature, you're simply shutting down something that is going on in the plant that in a way to create a more domesticated species. Do you think that describes the situation?
Yeah, this is the kind of manipulation that we can do now easily. But I think that in the future, the technique of CRISPR-Cas, for example, is evolving, and in the future we will be able to manipulate and also to create a gain of function, or that is in most cases, this means that you should do genome editing in the promoter region of the gene specific manipulation, and we can do this, and this is I think that we address in that paper, when in a second part of the paper where we talk about using genome editing to create a ideal type for a crop. So we discuss many physiological process that improve productivity. Now that we discovered cloning the genes behind them, and most of the genes now we can manipulate, but unfortunately some of them involves complex modification that we cannot assess now by genome editing, but I'm sure that in the future this will be possible. Yes.
So yeah, okay. So gain of function is coming through gain of function traits through CRISPR-Cas9 is coming.
Yeah, or more specific you're saying, but manipulation. Yes.
Specific manipulation. Yeah. Okay, great. So you have worked with numerous aspects of these wild tomatoes and the complex traits that they but important traits that they possess. You've mentioned stress tolerance in our conversations, insect resistance. Give us more about that. Tell us help the listeners understand.
We are very interested in insect resistance because in tomato and this is also the case of other species. Insect resistance it's related to a kind of structure that we call trichomes, that is. In the case of tomato, they are like organs that grows in the superficie of leaves, and that this is a good way to put base and applied resist together. Because, for example, Solano galapagensis is very insect resistant, and this is because Solano galapagensis has a kind of trichome that we call type 4 trichome that is able to produce a kind of compound that is, it's a natural insecticide that is acyl sugar. So there are many breeders that want to put this compound in tomato, in cultivated tomato, but we know that it's polygenic in nature because it depends on the genes that build the correct type of trichome and the genes that build the correct type of compound. So doing de novo domestication is a way to transform a plant that is resistant to salt and also very insect resistant in the cultivation way. That is the only thing that we have to do is to make the fruit bigger. And you ask me about the taste of the fruit. There are something interesting behind the fruit of tomato, that is all tomato or included the white species, they use to accumulate instead of a carotenoid. Tomato does accumulate flavonoid, and flavonoid is something that is very healthy for you, but sometimes it has a bitter taste. That's why many teas that we use to drink that is rich in flavonoid have this state, that especially those that are very good medicines. So they are bitter and they are good for you. But you are not able to perceive this in the cultivated tomato, because in the large fruit, this effect of this skin, because the flavonoid is only in the skin, you are not able to there is a kind of dilution in the large fruit of the flavonoid.
Oh, but sure.
In the case of the small fruit, you can taste this. So a good way to skip this bitter taste is just to enlarge the fruit. That is the target of the domestication.
This is all very interesting to me. And you know, as you were talking about insect resistance and these trichomes, these leaf hairs, you know, if for listeners who've ever seen an electron micrograph of a leaf hair, you know how complex it can be. And so you've got the complexity of the leaf hair and the genetics that create that leaf hair, and you've got the genetics that create the chemistry that is inhibitory to insects, and all that complexity. It's hard to imagine actually moving those genes into cultivated tomato. It seems to be, you know, so sensible to go the other way, as you've been describing it.
But in the case of trichoma, I should say that we do have the interest to move it then, or at least part of the genes that are behind the trichome development from the white species. Mm-hmm. To the tomato, but in this case is for a base research that in the future we will have that will be applied even to other species, because in the case of trichome, I think that I already said that there are many other species that produce very important compounds in trichome, and we can use tomato as a model to understand how to build a glandular trichome, the kind of trichome that produce compound, and we can apply this to many other crops that are actually producing very important compounds in their glandular trichome. So part of the work in our lab is using this white species and try to find monogenic traits that determine the trichome development. And I should mention that tomato is a very special model for this, because it's a plant with a small genome. It's genetically manipulated very easily. And it's like Arabidopsis, but with the difference that we don't have a glandular trichomes in Arabidopsis. So in the case of, for those people that are interested in trichome development, tomato is a very good choice.
Okay. Yeah. So de novo domestication makes sense with respect to practical insect resistance. But there's also what you're describing is that you're also going to try to move genes for trichome or leaf hair development into cultivated tomato as a model system for research purposes and maybe for application in both tomato and other crops.
Yes, this is important. And I think that the best way to do this is to, when you can use tomato to isolate the genes, and then you can try to find the homologous genes in other species, because we think that a very basic structure that can be conserved, the genes that have been recruited to make trichomes in tomato may be conserved in other species, and this will be very good. For example, I'll give you the example of Artemisia that is producing a drug that is important for malaria, that is a treat in Africa and then also in many places in South America, including Brazil. And we Artemisia is not a very good genetic model, but the kind of substance that is produced in the glandular trichomes of Artemisia, it follows a genetic pathway very similar that the one that we have in tomato, that is the artemisin. It's a sesquiterpene. And sesquiterpene is also a kind of compound that some white species of tomato use as a natural insecticide. So this is very interesting thing to have in mind.
You know, this is a stray question, Lacido, but is there can you rule out, or is it possible that trichomes have been lost in cultivated tomato because of accumulated loss of function mutations, just like you've seen in other genes?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question. What we discovered recently is that, for example, in the case of the kind of trichome that I mentioned, the type 4 trichome from Solano galapagensis, people used to say that this trichome is absent in tomato leaves, but we discovered that this is only true for adult leaves. For if you take a tomato seedling, you see this type 4 trichomes in the cotyledons and also in the first pair of juvenile leaves. And the interpretation for this is that during tomato domestication, or even the opposite, during the evolution of the wild species, there occurred some mutation that keep this kind of juvenility during the life cycle of the wild species, and this may be the what caused the presence of type 4 trichome in adult leaves of the wild species and not in tomato. So it may be related to the domestication of tomato. In this case, the kind of mutation is something opposite to juvenility, or it may occur in the wild species. In this case, the kind of mutation is something that is promoted juvenility. And this kind of mutation we call neoteny. Neoteny is a very interesting process that people that study development in animals and plants are very interested.
Yeah, well, this is all just fascinating. I do hope we get a chance to interact face to face again.
Yeah.
Before we end, is there anything else you'd like listeners to know about your research or about where it's going, what you've learned, anything?
Well, one thing that I think that is quite important is that we are using tomato as a model, because now is the best plant that we can use to prove the concept of de novo domestication. But I think that this can be extended to other crops in the future. And one thing important behind this is that this is also good for what we call food security, because people used to say that one very dangerous thing is that nowadays the number of the plants that we use for food are very narrow. So de novo domestication, it's a way to expand the number of species that we can use in the future as food, and this is a way to have more food security, because maybe the plants that we have now as cultivated plants are not the ones that will be very adapted to the new environment that climate change will create.
What a great point. Really very, very good point. I hadn't thought about it in that way, in terms of expanding, that just the food security by creating more buffered food systems that rely on greater numbers of crops. That's a great point. You know, and also your Solanum galapagensis example really was a case study, I think, what you're saying. So it's useful and it's important. But the concepts that you're applying and learning are going to be of utility to other crops or other wild species that could be made into crops.
Yes, yes, and in that paper we put some example of wild species that are related to very important crops. So it's not only in tomatoes.
You did. There's a table. One, I think it was. Yeah, that's right.
Very good.
Yeah,
and I think that one last point is that as you notice, this kind of approach, it involves both molecular breeding and also genetic transformation, but also a conventional breeding, because what we are doing is to do what the the Britain used to do that is to do crosses on something like this. And we like to put this both thing together. So what we have for the filter is to combine both techniques. It's white species that are related to cultivate plant, you can do this by using crosses. But when you have species that are not related to the cultivate plant, you can do this by genetic transformation, and this is very good approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that very good point, Lacido. So really, this is your program is not limited to genome editing. It's really a marriage of genome editing with conventional breeding, and so many good plant scientists recognize the value of really programs that incorporate both.
Yeah.
Lacido, it's been a pleasure to talk to you once again. We had such great times, and I hope to see you again down south or up here maybe in Kentucky, giving a seminar. So thank you for your time, Lacido. For Lacido Perez from the University of Sao Paulo.
My pleasure.
And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Talking Biotech. Write a review on iTunes and tell a friend to listen, as your support allows us to deliver more about exciting science to more people. I'm Paul Vincelli, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.